Our host needs no introduction.
His name is...
A name so simple it rolls right off your tongue.
His name is James... No, his name is... James Lawrence! Lawrence! Lawrence!
Try again.
Forrest Lone... Lars! Lars!
No! Chuck Jaffe.
Yes! 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 We're like this!
I'll say it again so you remember, okay? This is Money Life with Chuck Jaffe.
Wow! 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 All I can say is wow!
Please do not overdramatize these proceedings.
And now, here's Chuck.
He's one in a million.
He sure is.
Good morning and welcome to Money Life. For the final day of the first quarter, March the 31st, hard to believe we're this far into the year, but time flies when you're having fun. Hard to believe that I have 2 weeks left until tax day, and as much as I was saying on yesterday's show that I was headed to see my tax preparer, that got blown out of the water. I didn't wind up making that trip. Had to do some other things in the afternoon. Thankfully, my trusty tax preparer can move things back a little bit, so I got a reprieve of a few days, which really was only good for like double checking the math. I don't know that it does anything else that helps me or hurts me, really, about double checking the math, but I was kind of pleased with it because I knew I was going in with like, oh, I didn't find this or I didn't find that, and that was frustrating me. So now I'll get to all of that, and well, you know, we'll see what happens when we get through dealing with the tax man. Meanwhile, having at least dealt with yesterday and having put off the tax man, I got a great show planned for you today. So it's Thursday. That means we start with the ETF of the week. Tom Lydon joins us from ETFtrends.com. Then, well, I always ask you for letters. I got a pretty interesting one after I talked about Tobin Smith on yesterday's show. This was not your basic love note. No. Definitely not. I know the guy who wrote the note here. He is somebody who has written me periodically. I get the sense that there are times when he likes what I talk about and times when he doesn't, times when he just wants to poke the bear or what have you. It's a little tough to figure it out. But he was one of the folks who was all over me when I first wrote about Tobin Smith in a piece that cost Smith his job with Fox Business. And he was on my case again yesterday when I was talking about Tobin Smith having reached an agreement with the SEC on fraud charges. He's got an interesting question, and I think it deserves an answer because maybe you were out there thinking the same thing. But it's a question. It's about the show and conflicts of interest and selling advice and maybe selling your soul. So we'll talk about that after we get the ETF of the week. Then Bob Powell is in, and this week he's writing a piece about all these studies that have come out that have suggested that business areas that cater to what seniors want are going to be extremely popular courtesy of demographics, and that if you want to line your pockets with investments that are going to be successful, get things that are meant for the silver set, as it were, or people in golden years. I guess that would be, it's your golden years. You're the silver set because it's silver hair, like my mom. And after that, there's no Money Life market call today, but Stephen Wood, chief market strategist for Russell Investments, is going to join us. He's traveling. He's joining us from the road, but we get the opportunity to chat with him for an extended period, which is always good. Russell Investments just issued its most recent quarterly outlook, and of course, the second quarter is starting. Now, we have been booking, not only do we have a great show planned for today, we have been booking guests hard. And I have to say, as we turn the corner into April, I am starting to get very excited with what is coming. So let me give you a taste. Coming on Monday, you get Chuck Carlson from The Drip Investor. We're also going to have James Ricards, who is the author of The New Case for Gold. Bill Mann from the Motley Fool Funds is coming on Tuesday for the Money Life Market Call. Sandy Villery from the Villery Equity Fund on Wednesday for the Market Call. Leah Bennett from South Texas Money Management on Thursday. John Reese from Validia on Friday. The following week, our Market Call guests will include Sandy Sanders from John Hancock, John Thompson from Vilas Capital, and more. We've got no shortage. But we're also adding great big interview guests. Some of those folks, I mentioned James Ricards, author of The New Case for Gold. We will have Michael Ashton. He's the author of What's Wrong with Money. He'll be joining us next week. Patrick O'Hare from Briefing.com will be joining us. Stuart Ritter from T. Rowe Price. Adam Grimes from Waverly Advisors. He'll be here in a week for technical difficulties. By the way, tomorrow for technical difficulties, Jeffrey Hirsch will be joining us, editor of Stock Traders Almanac. Andrew Foster from the Seafarer Fund. That is a guest coming that is particularly of interest to a couple of you guys because he was suggested by an audience member. And then I've had a couple of folks saying, hey, do you know any good managers of international / emerging markets types of funds? And yeah, we're going to have one on suggested by one of you. So love that and glad that we're going to get a chance to do that. He'll be on close to the middle of the month. Jeffrey Salingo, author of There Is Life After College, helping our children figure out what to do. We'll also have Sandra Stoutenberg back from Investec and a whole lot more. And that's all coming in April. So plan to be with us each and every day. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. You can find my work online at MarketWatch.com. If you need help, then you're going to follow me on Twitter at MKTWJaffe. That gets you to my columns. At Money Life Show gets you information on the show. And both will get you information on things like, hey, I showed up at the financial food fight for WSJ podcasts and what have you. Money Life is independent personal finance talk, and we're going to discuss this more in that segment after the ETF of the week today. It is dedicated to looking smartly at a wide range of approaches and opinions on investing. It is not just what I like. It is what I think you can learn from, and that sometimes means doing things that are uncomfortable or putting on guests that I'm not a big fan of or I don't like their subject matter because, well, you can learn when you know what all sides are thinking. Love for you to get involved in the show. Like I said, Andrew Foster from the Seafarer Fund will be on the show in a couple of weeks because one of you suggested it. Don't be shy about suggesting guests. They don't always agree to come on, and there are one or two that I won't have on, but they're pretty good about going, wow, somebody asked for me, sure. So don't be shy about that. Requests for Hold It or Fold It, and much, much more. Send them all to chuck@moneylifeshow.com. All right, with all that out of the way, it is time for us to get busy. It is Money Life for March the 31st. Thanks for joining us. Our lineup, Tom Lydon, to me, to Bob Powell, and then Stephen Wood from Russell. We'll start things off with the ETF of the week in just a moment.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
It's ETF of the week time here on Money Life. That means Tom Lydon joins us right now. Tom, of course, editor of ETF Trends. And if you want more information on anything related to the ETF world, check out ETFtrends.com, which will not only get you Tom's insights and much more, but covers the ETF business from soup to nuts. They're on Twitter at ETF Trends. Tom is on Twitter at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chuck. It's great to be back.
Our ETF of the week is
the iShares JP Morgan U.S. Dollar Emerging Markets Bond ETF, ticker symbol EMB.
Okay, that's the iShares JP Morgan U.S. Dollar Emerging Markets Bond ETF, EMB. Now, There's a couple of things in there. Emerging markets bonds denominated in U.S. dollars, the U.S. dollar side of things. Why this fund right now?
Well, a couple things, Chuck, and you know us. We're trend followers. So the idea is look for areas around the world that may have been below their 200-day average for an extended period of time, and maybe that trend just might be changing. So typically, when we see opportunities like this, it may not feel that great in the stomach. It may not feel like now's the right time for something like this. However, EMB has just gone above its 200-day moving average, and that's something to take note of. The other thing is, from a yield standpoint, it's paying almost 5%. So if the trend is up, the yield is stellar compared to what you can get here in the U.S. It's something to take note of. The big question is, from a stability standpoint, is this something that's going to last for months and months and months? And the key thing is, nobody really knows. That's why we're trend followers.
That said, emerging markets bonds, well, the good news is you don't have to worry a whole lot about some of the things that are affecting domestic bonds. How do you decide where this money's coming from in terms of your bond allocation, and how big an allocation are you willing to give it?
Real good ideas here. First of all, when you look at emerging markets, it's diversified. So you've got a little bit spread in many of the most popular emerging market countries, like Mexico, like Russia, Indonesia, Turkey, Philippines, Brazil, China, Hungary. And it's not as though there's any one country that has domination as far as the overall allocation. That's really key, and that's really important, because we've talked a lot about currencies, and although we've seen a lot of volatility in foreign currencies in the last 5 years, there's not one area that's consistently up or down over time, and the fact that it's spread out makes it that much more appealing, which is really key. The other thing is, when you look at the overall yield being, say, on average 5%, and with treasuries paying, you know, on the 10-year less than 2%, and money market funds, as we know, paying less than zero or a little bit more than zero, not much at all, for a small allocation of your fixed income portfolio to something like this, especially if you're following the trend, you can really up your overall monthly yield. So consider this. Say in your fixed income portfolio, you put only a 5% allocation towards EMB. Your overall yield is going to probably increase dramatically based on what you have based in the U.S. And number two, if you do keep an eye on that trend, and as long as every month you continue to check in, you continue to stay above that 200-day moving average, every month you're doing more for your portfolio as far as increasing that overall yield. And listen, there's been a couple years where we've seen massive declines in emerging market debt. Who knows when overall global stability is going to kick in? And when it does, rates start to go down, and we start to see additional increase in the value of those bonds. That could mean you not only might have a decent yield, but you're also going to be in a position where you could have some appreciation.
You mentioned, of course, this is a 200-day moving average play. Is this straight out, you're going to play this 200-day moving average, and if it drops down below it, that's your out sign? Or is it, because this is diversifying your portfolio and getting you into an area that perhaps you haven't been, something where if it goes below it, you're going to go, okay, how much do I value the diversification over the trend?
This is really for trend followers. You can see as much as 20% volatility in the price of this ETF in a matter of 3 to 6 months. People don't think about that much risk within their fixed income portfolio. So keeping that in mind, you will continue to have volatility. However, you can control that volatility by watching the trend and watching the 200-day moving average. So if this is something that is interest to you, take advantage of it with a small allocation, number one. But number two, keep a close eye on that 200-day moving average. And if it does go below its 200-day moving average, that's the point that you sell.
One last question in terms of the construction here. When people talk about emerging markets, is this locked up in the BRIC nations? How big is any one country when we start to look at this in terms of the exposure somebody's going to get?
Yeah, so something we touched on earlier, it's pretty well spread out among all emerging market countries that are notable in the fixed income space. Mexico is the largest with 6.8%. So no allocation in a specific country gets me nervous at all. I think it's pretty well diversified across all emerging markets, which is another big plus. Also, as far as being investment grade versus speculative grade, most of this portfolio is in the investment grade area, which is triple B or above.
It's the iShares JP Morgan U.S. Dollar Emerging Markets Bond ETF, ticker symbol EMB. That is the ETF of the week from Tom Lydon. Tom, of course, the editor of ETF Trends. Tom, thanks so much for joining me on Money Life.
Thanks, Chuck.
Remember, if you want more information on ETF Trends, it's ETFTrends.com. On Twitter, at ETF Trends. Tom's on Twitter, at Tom Lydon. Well, that is a great start to the March 31st edition of Money Life. We'll come back in just a moment with the big interview when Money Life continues right after this message.
Hightower is a groundbreaking team of financial advisors committed to giving you access to best-in-class financial products and services, a practice often overlooked by brokers on Wall Street. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
We're back on Money Life, and I'm always encouraging you to write me notes, to ask questions, and I don't mind being challenged at all. So I got one that's kind of challenging after yesterday's show. Now, yesterday, I ran you through the situation that had enveloped Tobin Smith. Toby Smith became known when he was working for ChangeWave Investor. Off of the success there of his newsletter and his stock picks, he wound up becoming a personality on Fox. And he went from being, I'm a guy that shows up on Fox, which happens to some of us, it happens to me too, right? He went from that to becoming a regular contributor on Fox and then doing more and more to where he spent 13 years basically working for Fox, was on Fox Business, called himself a guest anchor, and he had a contract with Fox. And it was that contract with Fox that he was violating when he got back into the newsletter business. So he sold ChangeWave Investor, his newsletter, got back into the newsletter business with something called NBT for Next Big Thing. And I wrote a column in June of 2013 that talked about how he was promoting some stuff and getting paid to promote stocks. That was in direct violation of his contract with Fox. Fox, of course, owned by Dow Jones, which owns MarketWatch. So, you know, he was doing stuff that I'm not allowed to do. Didn't expect him to get fired because I was writing about sponsored research, but he did get fired. Well, then he had some other stuff where he was basically overzealous in promoting other penny stocks, one called IceWeb, and the SEC filed charges with him. He agreed Tuesday to settle and pay almost $260,000 and to not be involved in penny stock stuff going forward. So after I talked about it, where I really was just kind of laying out a lot of the case and more, and I only did it at the beginning of the show, I got the following note from Roger in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And yes, I have heard from Roger before. And he said, Chucky, so you are picking on Tobin Smith again, and then you go on your show and say that being paid to promote a stock is different than being paid by someone who appears on your show. Well, I'd like to hear the difference, because I think you were talking out of both sides of your mouth. I don't think you'll answer, but I'll listen for it. I want to hear how you explain your way out of this one. Roger in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Now, look, I'm not a big fan of anybody just out of the blue calling me Chucky. I don't like most nicknames for Chuck. I've been called a few of them. Now, picking on Tobin Smith, I wrote a piece for MarketWatch yesterday that covered the story, that talked about what had happened with Tobin Smith. Look, he made his reputation as a Fox News or Fox Business analyst. That's what made him famous. His last name is Smith. I'm sorry, you can't write headlines that say Smith does whatever, because a lot of people back in 2013 said I was picking on Fox Business. Fox Business was a sister company. But okay, let's talk about what happened here. Tobin Smith took money to promote stocks. He did not properly disclose that. You're wondering how that is different from somebody who is a sponsor of the show and then appears on the show. Well, one, we try to always disclose it right up front. And two, while I don't control what someone says on this show, I do control the opportunities that they get. And I do make them disclosing. So here's what you need to know. If you listen to this show, we have had a few folks who have been sponsors, such as Hightower Advisors, and we do collective wisdom with Hightower Advisors, and a failed, but I hope we can somehow rekindle it, sponsorship from the Forbes Real Estate Investor, Brad Thomas's newsletter, where we were doing the Intelligent Read of the Week. Now, Brad disclosed every single time what he owned if he was discussing something, as, by the way, do all of my guests. The Hightower gang, they're not coming on going, hey, let us talk about our favorite stock. You should buy this. In fact, they don't want to talk individual names. I wish I could push them more to do it. So what's the difference? Well, there's a few things. One is that in both cases, while they came and asked to sponsor the show and looked to get a presence on the show in the process, there were folks that we would have had on the show regardless. Secondarily, if they go away tomorrow, you know, I'm not getting more compensation based on something that they do or anything else. I get paid if we've got sponsors on the show. I need more sponsors to make more money. There's no question about that. But I'm not in a position where we're saying, hey, let's suddenly do something that is motivated entirely by the other side, because we've got advertisers. We're hoping to keep advertisers. We always want more. If you know people that want to advertise with us, point them in our direction. But independent is something that we talk about, because I've never been once told, here's what the question you can ask. You know, you want to know the difference? The difference is Tobin Smith in the SEC case was talking about a stock that he said he found when his company was looking to do data storage stuff. But instead, that wasn't the truth. The only way he found the company was when they paid him to promote it. And that is ridiculous. It is. And he should have known better. And I believe he did know better. You know, if you go to read my columns at MarketWatch, you will find that there's plenty of stuff around them that I hope nobody ever clicks on as advertising. And if you were reading my columns in newspapers, I used to hate half the ads that would be around it. It's fairly natural. Folks who are in editorial, we don't like advertising. The interesting side is that in this day and age, you can go onto a site like MarketWatch and you can find people who are not journalists. They are writing columns. They have very specific books of business. You know, they're writing for something like the trading deck at MarketWatch. Those guys, they have positions. And while the positions should be disclosed and hopefully are, because that's part of the MarketWatch rules, that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily pushing their book. And by their book, I mean the book of stocks that they own. They're not necessarily saying, oh, wait, you know, I want to make this thing go up, etc. So I think there's a line that gets crossed. You know, if I were ever in a situation where somebody said, hey, we want to do a regular segment on the show, we want to sponsor it, and we want you to talk all about something that you have no interest in talking about, life settlements. And we're going to talk all the time about how great life settlements are. There are radio shows that do this, by the way. There are radio shows that are bought time where a guy goes off and all he talks about is life settlements. You know, the cure for anything that ails you. Of course, life settlements are a horrible investment for the vast majority of people that try them. They are not wrong for everybody, but they are distinctly not mainstream. Everybody should go get one. Okay? If we had somebody who was paying to do that segment on this show, we would no longer be independent. We wouldn't. It would be, Chuck, we're going to talk about life settlements. And I'd go, again? I don't want to talk about life settlements again. And oh, by the way, all of our agreements basically say, if we ever get to the spot where somebody's asking me to say something that I don't want to say, we're not doing it. That's another part of the difference. Yes, there's going to be advertising and there's going to be disclosures about stuff that needs to be disclosed. That's okay. That's not an entirely bad thing. And neither is, hey, this is paid programming. You know, we've all figured out something that we bought from an infomercial where, hey, it really was good. And that's how they got it to market. Fine. I'll take a paid program. It's not necessarily a terrible thing. But when you know that that's what you're getting, you need to be careful. We've done a good job of vetting things here, but we're always vigilant about it. There is a difference between somebody being paid to say something specific, to promote something where they don't come to an independent conclusion, and someone who is being paid to facilitate discussion. We're not claiming, journalists should never claim that, like, oh, there's not advertising someplace else. The question is always, do you maintain your independence? And not once with anybody who has ever advertised on this show, been a sponsor of a segment, have they ever told me to pull my punches on a question? Have they ever seen the questions in advance? And even with somebody like Brad Thomas, who was doing the Intelligent Read of the Week, well, he didn't always know what I was going to ask because those questions might be different. And if I didn't like a pick, I was able to say, hey, you know, why this one? This one doesn't look as good to me, or what have you. So independence is possible even in an environment where it may not seem that way. And under any circumstances, everything is better when it's out in the sunshine. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. Disclose it. And it's not that it makes everything all right. It's not that you would have suddenly gone, oh, well, Tobin Smith, hey, those picks, they're suddenly great because you've disclosed that you were getting paid and I want to ride along with you while you maybe make this money, which, by the way, he didn't make the extra incentives. IceWeb was a terrible stock, and most of the stocks he was paid to promote have been terrible stocks. That's why I've always wanted him on the show to come and talk about the process, because he believes it works, and yet it typically doesn't. So, you know, he's paid to believe that it works. That's fine. That's fine. That's not a bad thing. The bad thing is crossing the line and breaking the law. Understand where the conflicts come from, folks. They are there even when we try to keep them out. There's always going to be some measure of conflict of interest. But if the conflict of interest is, yeah, I get to give a good message at a time and a place of my choosing, that's a very different thing from the conflict of interest is, look what I'm not telling you, where I'm coming on, and because I bought time someplace, I can lie to you. There you have it, Roger. I'm sure you disagree with me. I don't mind. All right, folks, if you got a question, don't be shy about sending it along. Chuck at MoneyLifeShow.com. Up next, Senior Focus with Bob Powell. And then Stephen Wood from Russell Investments. This is Money Life.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Your retirement years are coming. Are you financially ready for your retirement?
You know, I've been thinking.
Oh, that would explain the beads of sweat.
Don't let this happen to you.
I'm afraid it's just not sufficient to refinance your home.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
My advice to you is to start drinking heavily.
Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Bob Powell knows where to turn and how to help you with your financial needs as you plan for or live in retirement.
Here I come to save the day.
It's all here as Retirement Weekly's Bob Powell joins Money Life every week for Senior Focus.
Senior citizens, although slow and dangerous behind the wheel, can still serve a purpose.
Here he comes to save the day. It's Bob Powell, editor of Retirement Weekly, joining us for Senior Focus. Bob, of course, beyond Retirement Weekly, is a columnist in the Retire Mentors section at MarketWatch, and it's all kind of related, because if you go find his columns, well, his Retirement Weekly is also a MarketWatch product. So you'll find his columns, you'll find links to Retirement Weekly, and if you want to find his columns or want some help, follow him on Twitter. He's at RJPIII. But right now he's here. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Chuck, thanks for having me on.
We normally talk about seniors in terms of what's going to happen as the front edge of the baby boom reaches retirement, starts pulling money out, and all these other sorts of things. But there has been some talk about how the generation that is now starting to reach retirement is creating its own set of new opportunities, isn't it?
Yeah. Right now, the lead to the column goes like this. If you're going to grow old, you might as well get rich doing so. What's happened is there have been a number of investment firms that have just produced reports suggesting that all this global aging is going to offer a silver lining to investors. Prudential Financial came out with a report. Wells Fargo came out with a report. And also last October, JP Morgan partnered with AARP to launch an investment fund that would invest in companies focused on improving the lives of people who are 50 and older. And so there were three themes that came out of both all these reports and this innovation fund, one of which focuses on real estate equals real opportunity. What Prudential suggested was that real estate represents about 40% of the gross assets of 65-year-old households in major developed markets, including the U.S. and the U.K. And so they identified at least three places where you might want to think about investing, not all of which are publicly traded, but, you know, that there's opportunity. So the first one would be homes and condos. They're suggesting that baby boomers are likely want an urban lifestyle. And so places like Raleigh, North Carolina, Nashville, Austin, Texas, Atlanta are becoming hotspots for aging boomers who want an urban lifestyle. Demand for senior housing is also growing. It's surging by about 850,000 new units a year or by 2030, which is about a 75% increase from 2010. This is not just in the U.S. Japan, China are also trying to, you know, meet the demand for senior housing. And then the last thing with respect to housing is a lot of biotech startups and medical companies and research centers, they're looking to buy land that are located next to universities where there might be some biotech research going on. Mm-hmm. So there's another place where you might be able to look at real estate opportunities. Again, not publicly traded. You may have to think about, in a, you know, alternative ways to buy the real estate in this regard. But there are some publicly traded opportunities. So Wells Fargo, for instance, suggested that real estate investment trusts that invest in medical office buildings may benefit from the aging trend. So there's at least one publicly traded opportunity. The other big trend would be that healthcare equals healthy investments. So pharmaceutical and biotech companies, those are, you know, looking companies that are targeting diseases like dementia, stroke, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, might be good companies to invest in. There's also this thing called silver tech, where people are looking to invest in companies that provide solutions for helping people with mobility issues or improving the delivery of medical care. So that, you know, there's a couple things, again, no names at the moment, but trends to watch for. And there will be companies, I'm sure, popping up in this area that we haven't even heard of yet. And then the last thing would be around alternative and other kinds of investments. Uh-huh. So one of the reports looked at this notion of looking at master limited partnerships, you know, where older people or maybe will be looking for income producing investments. I wouldn't suggest that people buy MLPs just because of their income producing ability. But, you know, there's an opportunity potentially, you know, to look at MLPs as something that aging investors will want to be in. And then the last one I'll mention, Chuck, is this notion that nearly half of the people over age 55 own a pet, and they tend to spend more than the average pet owner on their pets. So as this aging population grows, you know, pet companies, pet food companies, I don't know, pet insurance, all things pets.
Yeah.
Could be a good investment opportunity for folks.
There you go. And it makes complete sense. I've been watching that with folks I know for ages. And yeah, as this sort of turns, you could certainly see that having an impact.
I know my neighbors, there's no amount of money they won't spend on their pets. So I should have seen this trend from across the street.
Yeah, of course, their kids don't visit very often anymore, but but that's okay. They don't mind that either, because there is an amount of money that they would not spend on their children. And that's the transition from, hey, your kids were young, to your kids aren't young anymore. Now it's your pets that are your children.
And I don't have to send them off to college either. So
exactly. Exactly. Now, you know, the flip side of this, Bob, is that to some extent, people might have some of these things in their portfolio through just ordinary investing. Do we want to double down? Is it worth it to double down because you want to play the demographics here? Or is it that when you hear some guys who have come on the show talking about demographic trends, talking about, you know, hey, you're going to see the market go to hell when this stuff happens, is it that you use this to play against those demographic trends and say, well, these businesses will be more immune? Or, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is sort of like, you know, I don't know, it's investing in solar or something like that, right? I mean, I guess I've always been a big fan of core and satellite. So it's likely that, you know, you may have some exposure to these things already in your core portfolio. But if you don't, maybe there would be opportunities to think about a satellite position in pharmaceutical companies that specialize in dementia, chronic diseases, cancer, that sort of thing, or potentially REITs that invest specifically in medical office buildings. So I don't think you want to duplicate what you already have, but I think, you know, you might want to maybe add to the core in places where there may be opportunities. No guarantee, of course, right, that right. These demographic trends actually yield healthy investments for you. But I think on the surface, anyway, at least it's merits investigating.
Yeah, it does. It's an interesting concept. Bob, thanks so much for sharing it. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you then.
Bob Powell is the editor at Retirement Weekly. He is a columnist for MarketWatch.com in the Retirement Tour section. Find his work there and you'll find links to Retirement Weekly. Follow Bob on Twitter at RJPIII. We're heading for home on the Thursday edition of Money Life, so stay tuned. We'll be right back with more.
When it comes to managing your financial portfolio, Hightower's advisors don't limit your access to proprietary financial products and services, a common Wall Street practice. At Hightower, you get unobstructed advice. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Time to get ready.
Of course. Ready for what?
It's the big interview. Thinking big. Living big. Talking big with market strategists, money managers, economists, authors, and more.
Get ready to feel the thunder.
Long chats with big brains meant to give you a better view of the big picture.
As far as brains go, I got the lion's share.
As Money Life goes big time.
Big reason for this success is you.
Literally.
It's big interview time here on Money Life, and it doesn't get much bigger than my guest. Stephen Wood is the chief market strategist for Russell Investments. Russell just came out with its latest market update. If you want more information on the things that Stephen and I are talking about, well, go to russell.com, go to the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page, and find Stephen's picture. You will then find a link directly to their most recent Q2 update, or you can follow them on Twitter at Russell_news. And then when they release stuff like this, you'll know as well. Stephen Wood is traveling, joins us from the road. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the market outlook, you know, we talked with you back right around the turn of the year, and we were going through the hell of the first couple of days of the year. The market itself has since turned around, and you guys aren't necessarily looking at this going, hey, happy days are here again, but you are do seem to be looking at this going, well, we took that some of that scary stuff out, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the market outlook that we have reiterated for, you know, the upcoming quarter is, you know, very similar in many ways to the annual forecast we launched end of December coming into the end of the year when you and I spoke. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we put a lot of work into being as consistent and stable as possible. And in the market, you know, environment, which looked rosier in the beginning of the year, you know, some people thought that we were a little timid in our expectations. Then as the markets got choppy and moving into the end of February, when there's a lot of stress and downward movement in the market, then we looked a little bit more aggressive. And now the markets have snapped back and we're looking kind of center of the road again. And it's interesting to us that we just haven't changed that much because the market has been swinging around. And we think there's going to be a lot of commonalities that, you know, the economy, as you and I have been discussing for a while, you know, it looks in that 2% range, you know, kind of that C plus, maybe a C minus, depending on any given quarter, a range for the United States. So the economy looks okay, seems to be chugging along. We do not see a recession as the highest probability outcome for 2016. So to reiterate, we do not see a U.S. recession as being our base case scenario. We didn't previous quarter. We don't see that right now. So the economic forecast looks very stable from that perspective. Valuations are becoming a bit of an issue as we've seen the market rally. But by and large, we are very comfortable with our 2016 forecast, and we're just using this opportunity, however, of the rallies to create a more globally diversified multi-asset strategy, and something that if you care to explore, but, you know, for example, we would think that an underweight U.S. equities is probably appropriate given, you know, that, you know, there's, you know, the Federal Reserve might be raising rates in the near future by the end of the year, whereas Europe's cutting rates. The economic cycle in Europe's beginning, whereas it's kind of getting mature in the U.S. So some investors look at an underweight U.S. and then the false choice of or cash. And we don't think that's appropriate. In global portfolios, you can have an underweight, which is not the same as a short, mm-hmm. and use that underweight to fund a slight overweight someplace else. So I'm spending a lot of time kind of cautioning advisors not to paint themselves in the corner of a false binary choice.
From the perspective of what investors are going to see this year, back when we were talking in January, you said it was really too early to factor much with the election into things. And election years tend to normally be benign. But this is hardly a normal election year. At what point do we start to see some of the wildness of politics entering in and affecting the market and the market's outlook?
Yeah, that could be the first time the word benign has been used in election season this year. So I'll congratulate you on that. You know, we do our very, very best to never talk politics, but to look at policies. And I think that serves us well. You know, these are very strongly held opinions that people have, and they're certainly entitled to have those opinions. What we try to do is be far more clinical and just look at the policies that are likely to arise. And you're right, you know, the policies that have changed over the last couple of quarters or the last couple of years have really been negligible. And so the policy environment in Washington, D.C., some call it gridlock, others might call it consistency, haven't really changed a lot. So what we would want to do is when we kind of blow away the smoke and, you know, the theatrics of an election cycle, what are the policies which have a material impact on one's portfolio that are likely to change in a material way? And that's how we assess whether it's, you know, a Clinton White House or a Trump White House or some other White House. What are the regulatory legislative policies which directly impact investments which are likely to change dramatically? And that list is not terribly long. So I don't want to make the election season too unfun for everybody. And hopefully I haven't drained all of the fun out of the election season, but hopefully I have as well. That the policy shifts that we're going to see are negligible in many ways. I don't think there's going to be great movement on taxes. I don't think there's going to be movement on the repatriation of foreign earnings. I can't imagine there's going to be significant immigration reform or energy reform. So the likelihood that we're going to get significant policy shifts after this election season is put to bed, I think is not terribly high. I think we're just going to have to go back to looking at economic cycles, interest rate environment, Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, looking where we are in terms of valuation, risk-adjusted returns, you know, all the blocking and tackling, that quantitative work that really does affect portfolios in a much more significant way than will be the more wild winds of politics.
And you see this kind of environment occurring even in the situation where we've got, where realistically We haven't heard a lot about policies. We've heard a lot about who you might vote for or who you might vote against, perhaps, but we haven't heard a lot necessarily about specific sorts of policies, which has led to days like the one we had not that long ago where, you know, Hillary is tweeting about biotechs and the biotech industry sort of goes crazy. Are you worried that we'll have not necessarily long-lasting stuff, but that functionally, as we start to see the policies go, if there's any hint that status quo, which is kind of what you're expecting, is not on the table, that will at least kick up the volatility?
I think it could kick up the volatility. You know, and the president is certainly a very influential person. But I think Americans are well served to be reminded that domestically, presidents are not that powerful. You know, internationally, extremely so. But domestically, the president is one of many very significant power brokers and decision makers. There's the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader in the Senate, minority leaders in both houses. So there are a lot of extremely influential people that control the process at multiple points. So the president is the most visible, but it's far from certain that the president is the only voice in domestic policies. And I think if I had to look at a debate, which is going to be the most relevant. Very recently, Dr. Janet Yellen, the head of the United States Federal Reserve, spoke on interest rate policy. There are great conversations going on among very capable professionals on the Federal Reserve about will the Federal Reserve raise 1/4 point or 2/4 points or 3/4 points? If so, over what time period? For my money, that policy debate is far more impactful. What's happening in the European Central Bank? We just have been believers for some time and continue to be that this is a central banker's world and that the conversations and the policy debates at the central bank level in Japan, in Europe, in the United States, and increasingly likely in China are going to be very, very meaningful. So if I had to tune into one channel, I think it might be the Janet Yellen channel and figure out what she is saying. I would definitely subscribe to that cable service, to the Janet Yellen channel.
For investors, you know, you talk about being underweight and where you are in terms of allocations. At this point, are we at a spot where investors who perhaps haven't rebalanced for a while ought to, and just kind of look at it that way, keep things going? Or do you worry at some point that folks, you know, use every kind of news headline and every, okay, let's do whatever to kind of rebalance and use rebalancing as a timing tool?
Yeah, clearly they want to work with a professional. We do strongly believe that having a qualified, capable financial advisor is in an investor's best interests. That's true, we think, on the large plan, large pool of capital, as well as the individual and the retail. And I think being very disciplined is very important in this environment in terms of rebalancing. As a general statement and maybe as a specific statement, responding to short-term wiggles and squiggles in the market is probably not a good quantitative basis to make a move. Rebalancing, I think, needs to be done in a very methodical, well-researched, and disciplined way. You know, there's quarterly rebalancing, annual rebalancing, staying on line with one's long-term goals. Then also, I think within a portfolio, you know, what we're talking about at Russell is not just global, not just multi-asset, but also actively managed. So in the hands of a professional, there are opportunities to understand risk better. And where one has reasonable expectation that one is not going to get paid, one would want to take steps to avoid that. Where there's a reasonable expectation of getting paid for a risk, one would want to understand how to harvest that risk. So there are short-term opportunities, higher frequency opportunities to manage the risk and the return in the portfolio. And then rebalancing longer term takes advantage of some of these misallocations in the market. You know, you and I were talking just a few moments ago, and we have previously about how expensive U.S. equities have gotten after, you know, a very smart run since 2009. And is that an opportunity for investors who are overweight position A versus position B to reallocate? You know, we think that could well be a great conversation to have. There's no such thing as a typical portfolio, but where valuation ceases to be a tailwind and become a headwind, that's when you got to start doing your homework about where are valuations attractive, where is the business cycle attractive, where is the central bank and the rate environment likely to be accommodative as well. So it needs to be global, multi-asset, and active, in our opinion.
I want to go back to something that you talked about briefly, like you just kind of touched on it when you were talking about weightings. And in the global market outlook that Russell Investments did, you talked about it extensively. And that is the idea that although your outlook really hasn't changed a whole lot, the one thing that has is you are a little bit less sanguine about, hey, every dip is a buying opportunity. It's it's actually changed a little bit from buy the dips and move towards sell the rallies. And of course, that's a little bit of what we were talking about with on the rebalancing side in terms of what folks are doing. Why, when we've just come through a stretch where you saw the crushing performance at the start of the year, and now you've seen, you know, the last 6 weeks with the market basically picking up speed and getting back to the levels that folks, I think, were expecting it to be at, why are we not in a buy the dips environment, and why are we in a sell the rallies environment if you're not expecting a change in the return output for the year?
Yeah, and so essentially the U.S. in terms of the economy, as I mentioned, is going to be in about that 2%. We expect the U.S. equity markets to be flattish, up single digits, but kind of more in the flat than the upside, but slightly up. And that's U.S. And you're very, very right to bring out that level of granularity in that in the U.S., you know, buying the dips has translated into sell the rallies. And after, you know, a volatile first quarter with a sell-off and then a snapback, in these environments going forward, as we move into the second quarter, at these valuations, and I keep coming back to the boring stuff, but it's important, economic cycle and valuations, at these valuations in the United States, we think that this could be an opportunity to sell a bit of the rally and then look globally. You know, for example, in Europe, where valuations are not as high, where the economic cycle, as I mentioned, is beginning, where the European Central Bank is not raising rates, but they're going negative and they're really revving the accelerator. So the sell the rallies is, again, you know, a more shorter term, higher frequency rebalancing strategy that can look at valuations and understanding that there are nuances, there are these subtle differences, and sometimes there's bigger differences globally. And we're talking multi-asset as well, equities, fixed income, real assets, hedging strategies as well, where you can look at where there are global opportunities that are more attractive. So that becomes, once again, you know, I look at valuations as something like a gravity. You know, in the short term, you know, it may not look that powerful, but you know, when you stretch it over large spaces and large periods of time, it becomes extremely powerful. So valuations ultimately are very, very important, and one needs to keep an eye on those at all times.
Last question, Steve. From, you know, we've talked a little bit about volatility, and what we have seen is a significant pickup in volatility. At this point, should people stop sort of thinking of volatility as, I mean, is there ever going to be a reason why we don't see volatility? I mean, it just sort of seems like the level has ramped up, and now it's been fairly consistent. And it's the odd day these days when you go, wow, there wasn't a lot of volume and there wasn't a lot of back and forth, even when the day itself is flat. Is volatility at this point for consumers just noise? I mean, we keep hearing about it, but is it something that if you're an average investor, it's a day-to-day condition that comes with investing? Don't worry about it.
Yeah, we think, you know, volatility is going to be a travel companion for a while. And this is the nature of these global markets. You know, there's a lot going on. Oil has moved significantly. Chinese growth has decelerated significantly. The interest rate cycle from the world's central banks, as I mentioned earlier, is a different environment. So as markets reprice around that, you should expect some volatility. Now, the other way of looking at that, from 2011 to 2015, U.S. markets were very low in terms of volatility. And maybe to some degree, this is a matter of recent perspective, that investors got used to this gradual upward climb over a more than 4-year period with extremely low volatility. And now we're returning to more normal levels. So relatively, the volatility is high, but also volatility can be an ally as well. Looking at opportunities, as I mentioned, to understand risk, to try to avoid, to try to harvest risk, looking globally. So volatility can also be a tool, if well understood, that can potentially contribute to your long-term risk-adjusted return.
Well, Steve, great stuff always. Thanks so much for taking time out while I know you're on the road to join us here on Money Life.
My pleasure.
Stephen Wood is the chief market strategist for Russell Investments. If you want more information, go to russell.com. If you want to go straight to their second quarter global market outlook, go to the Money Life Show recent and upcoming guest page. You'll find a link there where you find Stephen Wood's picture. You can also follow the firm at Russell_news. There's just a little more to go on today's show. We'll get to it right after these messages.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors Incorporated.
Welcome back to Money Life. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show. Thanks for taking the journey with me. Fun getting a chance to chat with Stephen Wood. I appreciate his taking the time out for us. He was traveling. He basically says, oh, you caught me in my native environment. I'm in an airport. So always great to get a chance to chat with Steve. We've got big things planned. You heard me talking about some of the guests coming up. There is a lot of great stuff coming tomorrow on this show. Jeffrey Hirsch, editor of Stock Traders Almanac, will be one of our guests. Greg McBride, of course, and much, much more. Monday on this show, Chuck Carlson and a whole bunch more. So plan to be here each and every day. Get involved and don't be shy about sending us questions that are critical. I don't mind Roger's take on things from the question that I asked today. I think it's good to have the discourse. I think having the discourse is important. And I know that, well, a lot of people might be uncomfortable and we're not hiding anything here. If you want to know how something works, don't be shy. We will answer the questions. We want to make sure that you understand how it works and what we're doing and how we try to make sure that we don't have conflicts of interest, even when we know that at times we may now and in the future be doing things like allowing somebody to sponsor a segment and be a regular guest on the show. So ask us the questions. If it helps you get more comfortable with what we're doing, we certainly would be happy to answer them. All right, enough of all this. We got to get out of here. Thanks again to my guests from today, Tom Lydon, Bob Powell, and Stephen Wood. Thanks to Rob Floyd, my producer, and thanks so much to you for being here. Now, as we get into next week, we're going to have tax quotes from now until tax day. So today's the last one that's not tax related, and it comes from John Kenneth Galbraith, who said, "Wealth is not without its advantages, and the case to the contrary, although it has often been made, has never proved widely persuasive." Yeah, take advantage of the wealth, but don't forget, until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
This show is an informational service only. The information provided herein is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities of any kind, and not to be considered a recommendation to buy any stock, but an information resource to aid the investor in making an informed decision. All listeners should consult a qualified professional before trading in any security or pursuing any financial or tax strategy. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed as to its accuracy or completeness.